danger.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to episode 63 of the Innsworth Book Club. As you can see, we've brought you once again to the faded splendour of the Gillman Hotel, where every room has running water, usually down the walls, but there we go. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Poynton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. Yeah, we're going to be joined by a couple of guests this week, aren't we, Rob?
Yes, we are. Yes, indeed. But before we get into that, I believe we've got some news items lined up. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the Innsmouth Literary Festival later, shall we? Because our guests are involved.
Yeah, and I believe you've put up a new Kickstarter for Innsmouth Gold, haven't you?
Yeah, it's the latest Innsmouth Gold anthology. It's the number six we're up to now. And blimey. It's entitled The Pickman Papers. Nice. So it's Lovecraft in a Dickensian setting. And we've already got some great stories coming in from the usual crowd at the Innsmouth Writing Circle. Glyn Owen Barris, Miguel Frigueur, John DeLaughter, etc., etc. And we've got some really exceptional artwork for this one as well from Graveyard Designs, our friends at Graveyard Designs. Real nice kind of Victorian style engraving photos. So we're really looking forward to that. We'll put the link down below. And if you could support that, it will be much appreciated.
Yeah, I'm having great fun writing for that. Because I do a lot of that Victoriana anyway, so it was right up my street. So I've got to do something I've been itching to do for a long time. I've finally had the excuse to do it, so really excited about that.
Excellent. All right, so shall we get upstairs and meet our guests?
Indeed.
Let's tread those steps to room 428. And let's welcome our guests for today. It's Graham Patrick and Steph Hoyle. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Hello.
Yep. Hi. All good.
So, is this your first time in Innsmouth?
I've lived in Sunderland for about 17 years, so perhaps it's got some similarities. So it's an ex-shipping sort of town, so, you know, it's got a lot of similar things that are going on. But, yeah, it's... It's always nice to be here, I guess.
It's not many people say that.
we've noted the similarity between Innsmouth and a lot of British seaside towns and ports before.
It's kind of spooky, isn't it?
So. It's that East Coast thing, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So. How about you, Steph?
Well, following on from that, although it's not a seaside town of any sort, it has a lot of strange residents. So I grew up in Luton, so lots of strange people there. Myself being one of them, I guess. But I've never been to Innsmouth before. I've travelled around America quite a lot, and actually worked for a couple of summers on kids' summer camps in the early 90s, and that was all in New Hampshire and New York and Catskill Mountains and that kind of stuff. Took the Greyhound bus around, but never found this lovely little bus which you've laid on for us to take us to this lovely hotel with the running water down the walls.
Yeah. It's you have to have special tickets for the special bus, the big yellow bus. Yeah. And our main hope is that it doesn't break down, of course, because that's always a bit of an issue.
I find it better to bribe Mr. Sergeant with a bottle of bootleg booze. That way you know that he'll make sure you get out again, because you'll be bringing him some next time. That's what I find, you know, the old Zadok Allen trick, basically.
I was actually really impressed, because at the moment all the bus fares are really low, so I could just go anywhere I wanted for like £2 or something, or $2. So yeah, it was all good.
All right, so you guys are very involved in Cthulhu role playing and writing and scenarios and podcasts and that kind of thing. So perhaps we could start with Graham, and perhaps you could tell us something about your background and how you first got into weird fiction and Lovecraft, that kind of thing.
Probably in my late teens, got into sort of the sort of fringe of Lovecraft. We kind of like heard about Call of Cthulhu through our games club, because obviously we're in the cool clubs. We went to all the D&D games and vampire and all the rest of it. So that's how we kind of heard about this sort of fringe game where you don't want all the magic items, you kind of like don't want any of that sort of thing because they'll corrupt you and change you, you'll go mad and you'll end up killing each other with your hands wrapped around your friend's throats and all that sort of good stuff. And yeah, we had a sort of, I think Delta Green was actually the first thing I ever played. There's a guy called Sean, who was my friend's sort of brother-in-law's. I think he wrote for Traveller at the time, and he ran as a DG game. And it was the first sort of introduction to Call of Cthulhu, sort of properly. But other than that, from media and all sorts of things, I think I read Dagon at school, that sort of thing. But yeah, so we were, so it was always there, but we never really got into it massively until maybe 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years maybe max. So yeah, sort of a roundabout sort of way.
How about you, Steph?
Yeah, so similar in some ways. So probably in the 80s, we were playing a lot of role playing games. Obviously, the sort of the gateway drug being Dungeons and Dragons. So playing a lot of that, yeah. And we went to a local club in Luton called South Beds Immortals, which was a fantastic place for teenagers to be on a Saturday afternoon. Kept us out of lots of trouble, I think, or I like to think. But we'd play, the main games we played there were like, at the time were Bushido, Champions, Dungeons and Dragons, those kinds of games. And then someone brought in Call of Cthulhu as a role-playing game. And it was so different to all the ones we'd been playing. You know, you had the insanity mechanics and all this other kind of stuff within it. And that's really where I probably first latched onto, oh, right, this is based on this kind of world that this writer, this Lovecraft guy has put together. And then from there, over the years, kind of dipped in and out, read a bit, didn't read a bit. And then fast forward many, many years till probably just before lockdown. And started sort of looking at, I'd seen there was a new edition of Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game out, and then latched onto that, and then lockdown happened, started figuring out how am I going to do some gaming now, and then, well, that's where I met Graham actually, on his Discord server.
Yeah.
Started playing some games there, then thought, oh, I quite like doing this, then started playing some games and reffing them, and it just kind of went from there over the last couple of years for me. So I mean, I'm still no literary expert on Lovecraft at all. I kind of read them. I like some of them, don't like some of the others. But the actual the thought behind it and this, you know, the cosmology behind it, if you like, in terms of what it means and the horror is really what enticed me into it, because I'm a scientist by trade. So seeing what's behind the science is really an interesting twist for me.
And I guess I think Tim will agree, for its time, Call of Cthulhu was very different because everything else, well, I suppose it was pretty much D&D and Traveller were the two main other things back in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. And D&D was basically murder everything you see and punch the gold.
It still is.
Probably, yeah. I think Traveller's the only game I've played where you can actually die before it even starts, which is an interesting
death during character generation is quite a odd way of promoting the game.
short game,
yeah, that's a short movie, that one, isn't it? But I think Call of Cthulhu did introduce, well, I suppose it's almost like a detective game in a lot of ways, with that added sort of horror laid on top.
Absolutely,
yeah, it's very investigation heavy, in fact, and it's one of the things that makes it stand out from most other systems, I think, is that you have to actually solve some sort of aspect of what's happening before you can actually confront whatever's sort of plaguing your players, really. Where D&D is kind of like, just, I said, mashing things with hammers and swords and stuff. It's quite a different sort of caveat, though. I think more games are moving into investigative angles these days.
Yeah,
I said that one of the main differences, which I found, was all the role. I think all the role playing games I've played in the past, and they're all based on improvement. You get better as you go up levels, or you gain more skills, or you gain more powers, or whatever it is. Whereas Call of Cthulhu, you're never going to be as good as when you started.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Pretty much. You're going to deteriorate over time. And that's a really interesting way to play the game. And it feeds into the investigation about trying to... It helps with that, trying to not reveal the mythos side of it as well, and actually make people be afraid of their character confronting this stuff, because they know that could be the last encounter they ever have, you know?
Yeah, you play a victim, basically, rather than a hero. That's the kind of the biggest different angle there. Yeah, it's all about the brutalities of humanity and like all these things just under the veil of behind the next corner and all that sort of thing. You sort of always sort of like don't know what's going to go next in the sort of story.
Yeah, I think that's what appealed to me really was that I was always a weird kid, so the sort of reverse power fantasy really appealed to me. It's like I was always into horror even from a really early age.
Yeah.
So that feeling of helplessness and the unknown and all that, yeah, I found it incredibly enticing. I was also a really big fan of Agatha Christie growing up, because I was pretty much raised by my grandparents, and they had all of the Agatha Christies, you know, that generation. So I was really into that kind of detective thing. So it was just perfect for me. Yeah.
It's that same time frame as well, isn't it? I suppose Christie was a little more 30s, whatever, but it's that same sort of era.
Yeah.
I just wonder if that's an interesting thing in terms of player reward. Like, that seems to be such a common thing if you play computer games or whatever. You progress to the next level, you know, your D&D ranger, you go from first to whatever you become. I can't think of many games where your reward is insanity and hopefully a fairly painless death. It's an interesting setup.
Yeah.
The best you can hope for is to vaguely be alive and vaguely compass mentors at the end of it. That's the best outcome.
They're the best stories, to be honest. It's like going through that character journey where you're just completely brutalized through the whole thing. At the very end, you're just sort of walking out into the sunset. And it's like everyone else is dead around you.
Yeah.
We played Mass for about a year, almost 18 months or something like that. And not many of the players made it out of that alive.
Mine did.
I can imagine.
Yeah, yours did.
Hey!
I think the only other sort of thing that came close or certainly was a game changer in the same sense was Vampire the Masquerade.
Yeah.
Which had a very different approach again from D&D or Call of Cthulhu.
Well, we kind of grew up with that. That was the main thing we played back in the day was Vampire and Hunter as well.
Same.
And Hunter is very, very similar to Call of Cthulhu in a lot of aspects. So you know nothing about what's going on. You just know there's this fucked up sort of like supernatural thing like haunting your neighborhood, and you've got to get together with your mates and try and kill this thing, which is like not playing by the same conventions as anyone else. And we sort of really love that sort of aspect of it. It's like we don't actually know. And the World of Darkness has this cool sort of thing where it's got all these interlaced books of monsters that you're meant to be playing, and the hunter is just another monster. And then it's the sort of like the sort of bad end of humanity where you're playing these people who will step over the line into being vigilantes and don't know where that line is anymore because of way beyond it, sort of thing, just hunting down these creatures. And I mean, every investigator in Call of Cthulhu ends up being a criminal of some sort of stripe, whether it's breaking into something, burning something down, or just outright murdering the wrong people and just going, ah, shh. Just put that on. I mean, give them a dead body and that's pretty much a whole story right there, because they've got to get rid of this dead body and they've got to get all the authorities involved, and then all the lies just build up and accumulate, and at the end of the day they're just screwed, and that's the best one, you know. So
it's certainly having the aspect of the game set in relatively normal times, you know. Yeah. In Call of Cthulhu, it's like normal people going about their business, and somehow they get dragged into this strange, horrific world, and then they've got to try and manage that. So going through that process, although maybe the 1920s, although it can be modern day and many other periods of history, but the players can put themselves in those shoes, because they kind of know what the technology is at the time. They kind of know what the kind of framework was for lore and stuff like that. So they know they're committing stuff. So I think that's one of the big payoffs of the game. You know, it's kind of, it's not I'm down a dungeon and it's just kind of I'm going to bash things up. It's, you know, it's kind of real to the person, because they understand how it would really work if this was really happening.
Yeah, I think that helps with connecting with the horror aspect of it as well. It's like it's an everyday sort of setting sort of thing, especially playing modern. And it's very easy to get people who have never even done role-playing before into it, because you don't have to explain any sort of elaborate setting story or setting background. It's just, this is the everyday world and you've got this thing, you don't really know what it is coming up to you, or it's sort of invading your life and just making things hard for you. And then everything just gets flipped on its head, and then you don't know anything. You're not meant to know anything as well. So it's like, yeah, it's perfect. You know what I mean? You sort of, well, figure it out, solve it, see how far you can get without being turned into a gibbering mess.
I think that's the thing with cosmic horror, just in general, is like from a writer's perspective, is the fact that you can put it anywhere. You can do anything you like with it. The only real restriction is your own imagination, really. You can put it in the local supermarket if you want, or an Eldritch Abomination in the back room of an off license. Go for it.
Yeah,
you
know? Sounds good to me. Let's do it.
I met one of those once in East End. But that's another.
Back to Ensmith, are we?
Poundland.
Yeah.
It sets up that nice moral ambiguity in a lot of ways, because you might be murdering people, but it's for the greater good.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Or is it? But is there even a greater good? In a way that I think the only time I've heard of it in Dungeons and Dragons, we were chatting with Jeff Goad from the Appendix N podcast just recently about this, was I think someone had a scenario where you go in and you slay this room of ogres, and then you go in the next room and there's a bed with little baby ogres on it.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is very different for D&D, and it immediately sets that challenge. Well, what are you going to do now? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's kind of rare to see that. Whereas in Call of Cthulhu, you've almost got that conundrum pretty much every session.
Yeah, it's moral dilemmas and personal choices. Basically the core of the game. It's what you want to do with your character. How dark do you want to go? And you can get some real dark stories with the Call of Cthulhu for sure as well. It is a horror game as well as an investigative game. Even though some people will limit that horror to whatever sort of aspect you sort of like you're comfortable with. But growing up in the 80s and 90s with Vampire, which was real dark, if you've read it.
Oh yeah,
real dark. And I've just continued playing at that level sort of thing, and it's, some people love that sort of thing. They love getting involved. I mean, Cult's very big just now as well. And it is some dark stuff in that, and that's probably the darkest scenarios I've read in a long time. It does sort of harken back to that sort of early 90s role play. But it's there's tastes and tones for everyone, really, depending on what your group really is into, so you can tailor it. For sure.
So when you have a group, do you have like a, what do they call it, like a session zero thing, or you know, how do you gauge that level of horror with the group?
Generally, it's through sign up. You just be upfront and say, this is going to be a dark game. Here are the things that are going to really, really sort of like get to you. You're going to be talking to a therapist afterwards about. And if that's not for you, then this isn't the game for you. This is the easiest way to do it. Sort of just blunt honesty at the opening of the game. It's like, what kind of person are you? What do you enjoy? If you're not going to enjoy this, there's no point putting you through it, because it's going to make my life hard as well. And I'm going to have to deal with it. And everyone's going to have a bad time. So let's just make sure everyone's on the same page at the very, very start. And that could be a session zero as well. And sort of seeing where your lines, you've got X cards and veils and lines and stuff like that. That's where if you have a session that has a certain aspect or subject in it and you want to sort of include that, a veil would be, we'll just close the darkness on that. Just now we'll leave it there in the dark, which is actually sometimes grimmer than actually playing out, because your imagination should go like this. It's like, what is actually going on? And yes, some of the best sessions I've had have ended like that. They're just like trapped in tunnels, surrounded by these ghouls, closing in, your match goes out. That's just the end of it. Sort of thing.
Nice. Oh, that's brilliant. I love that kind of ending. It's like films that do that are always the ones that stick in my mind, because it's like you say, my brain just fills in all the blanks.
Yeah.
And it's much more horrific than anything that they would put on screen.
The idea is never to rob your players of their own imagination, because they will always terrify themselves more than you can. So one of the aspects of horror is like, less is more when it comes to these things. I mean, I'm known for describing things in sort of grim ways anyway. So what's that? it's like, if you just hold back that little last detail and just they're like, what happens next? Like, well, you don't know. You don't see that part. They're like, oh, it's okay, fine. And they're always thinking about it, sort of thing, when they come back to the table. It's horror is a very difficult thing to sell when it's around the table and everyone's familiar mm-hmm. with each other. Humor always creeps in as well. Humor kills horror so dead in a lot of ways. It sort of breaks that tension. You've got to build it back up again. But it's a very good like yin and yang for it as well. So there's always usually quite a lot of humor involved in Call of Cthulhu as well. It's sort of like that sort of, especially gallows humor as well. It comes up a lot, sort of thing.
Yeah,
I think it's something we say a lot, that Lovecraft, his sense of humor is underrated. I think a lot of the time his stuff is very darkly humorous, yeah. and that gets overlooked yeah. a little bit, I think.
I mean, the best example is Reanimator, isn't it? I mean, there's slapstick in that. Yeah. It's the sort of black humor slapstick stuff. It's great.
I think it's one of the things when you're running a session in terms of the sort of Lovecraft games or just horror games in general, you have to pitch it. So, you know, there's ebbs and flows in the game. And as the ref, you spend a lot of time trying to figure out, do I want to hit them hard now or do I want to leave it until the next bit? Or, you know, because obviously they're leading the way. But knowing when to have a little bit of levity and kind of allowing that, and then knowing when to hit them hard with some gore, but then knowing when to just back off and just kind of say, okay, you describe to me how this pans out. And so being able to kind of modulate the session so that it's trying to make sure that you get as much bang for your buck as you can in terms of the horror aspect is a fine art, you know. And yeah, you know, I've played with some really good keepers, Graham being one of them, and they can do that really well. And so it's when you're in a game like that, it really is a joy to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I think the mother of all DMs for that is probably Scott Dorwood. Mm-hmm. If you ever get him on, he's probably one of the darkest keepers I've ever sort of played with, and he is a delight to be GM'd by. It is all about just your timing. You kind of want to give people a silver lining. You always want them to hold hope up, or a sign that says hope this way, and sort of drag them into something and then just put it down and go, right, now what? And build the atmosphere. It's like atmosphere is like maybe 8% of the game is just building that atmosphere. It's like when you're going on about Innsmouth, it's like there's that deep forebodingness, like everyone's just staring out the windows at you, and you're just alone among this group of other people you don't know, and you're sort of walking these cobblestones, and it's like you can't go into a shop and be safe when you're getting followed because the shopkeeper's in on it and stuff like that. It's like this sort of, there's no way out sort of thing. And what do you do, you know? So,
and that's the power of Lovecraft as well, because I think again, something he's often not given credit for is he invented a lot of these tropes. I mean, sure, he borrowed from Poe and Dunsany and other people, but he actually invented a lot of this stuff as well.
Yeah, his writing is phenomenal in a lot of ways. What you're saying, it does hit on some humor. Some people forget it's like it was about weird pulp sort of fiction sort of thing they were writing at the time. It was meant to be fun as well, and a lot of that aspect is sort of comes and goes depending what you read. He writes so many different types of genre over the stories and all that sort of thing, from the sort of the dreamscapes and all that sort of fiction to outright horror, you know. So he knew how to change a story to fit what he was trying to tell. Sort of.
I think it's that sort of dive into the uncanny valley that I always find incredibly disturbing. It's like, you know, if you're walking down a dark street on your own, and you've had a couple, and you hear something off to the side, and something's not quite right, or somebody's looking at you in a slightly strange way. It's that uncanny valley, I think, that he really nails, especially in stories like Innsmouth.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that translates really well to role-playing, because everybody's had them sort of situations where they don't feel right, you know, if they've walked in the wrong pub on a match day or something. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I think people like to be scared, right? You know, that's part of it. You know, obviously people have their limits, but people like to, that thrill of being scared, you know, when you're a kid and it's dark or anything like that. That's part of our innate evolution. You know, there's that fear of the dark and fear of the unknown. And I think that's what the cosmic horror stuff does. It is that fear of the unknown, the fact that we are insignificant in the big scheme of things, and there's lots going on which we can't have any control over. I think that's such a big sort of sell for me in terms of the horror, in terms of the scale of it, you know, which I think is great.
And again, that takes it away from perhaps the more D&D approach where, I mean, one of my favourite D&D modules was it Ravenloft with Count Strahd the Vampire, which was, you know, gothic castle, everything, all the great trappings. But at the end of the day in D&D, you know, you can hold up a crucifix and you can do a few spells and you can defeat the monster. There's
You're the hero.
Yeah, there's no sense of that. You know, Nyarlathotep appears and you hold up your crucifix and...
Nyarlathotep laughs.
So it's that strange thing again of taking agency away from players, but that seems to improve the atmosphere.
Yeah, helplessness is a big part of like what you want to do with horror. It's like you can't be the hero in shining armor, and if you are, you should be murdered like straight away.
Definitely.
Go to a new character who's witnessed the murder, and then you're them. You can't be a hero because it takes away that sort of like the whole tension and atmosphere. Everything changes and it's a completely different story. But Pulp Cthulhu is quite popular, I'd say. Steph, would you say Pulp's quite popular?
It is with a lot of folks, but not with me personally, but I know a lot of people like it.
Yeah, it's like more, if you come from D&D, getting into Pulp Cthulhu I think is a good gateway drug. It's like you're still a hero, you're still facing these monsters, but there is limits, sort of thing to that. Like you can die in Pulp Cthulhu and just come back in a different scene, and you just come up with some elaborate nonsense that why you survived that scene. So again, going back to, if you don't want that victimization or that sort of helplessness, you can definitely play Call of Cthulhu in that sort of more levity, sort of driven way, for sure. But yeah, if you're going to play it with horror, why not? I mean, horror stories, a lot better than hero stories.
And one thing that interests me with Call of Cthulhu, Dungeons and Dragons, I know there are campaign settings and everything, but essentially at its core, the DM's got a map of the dungeon, and you can turn left or you can turn right. It's a bit like the old fighting fantasy books, right?
Text adventures.
Yeah.
I love them. I love all that stuff.
I mean, there's an element of that in some aspects of Call of Cthulhu. You're investigating an old tomb or something, but outside of that, I mean, in theory, your player characters can do whatever they want, right? I could jump on a plane and I'm going to fly to London and submit. So how do you get that balance between giving the players freedom to work, but also not letting them go totally off track somewhere?
Oh, that's seen behind the mirror, I guess, sort of thing. When you're playing Call of Cthulhu, your players are given signposts. These are usually clues and some sort of various sort of means. Either it's a person that comes up and says, this is what I know, this is what we need you to do, like a quest giver. That's quite similar to D&D sort of in that aspect. And then you get clues like they find some unfathomable sort of idol which sort of is leaking a sort of silvery liquid, and it makes them think of these sort of locations out in the sort of Pacific island, and they just have to go there no matter what. And yeah, it's like you can sort of direct them in certain ways. They can act against these things and they can go wherever they want, but you can always give them signposts. And if they go in a different direction, you just take that clue and stick it back in front of them over there, sort of rubber band it into a different way, or say that idol that that person ignored that was in the briefcase, then they might bump into a person on a plane who'd have that in their briefcase who did pick it up, and now they're on this sort of air, like tin cannon air, like 20,000 feet in the air with some mad guy raving about having to redirect the plane to the Pacific Islands, and they're going to have to land it on this tiny sort of place where it doesn't have a landing field at all, and they're screwed. But you definitely just redirect them the best you can. Let them have as much agency as they want, let them do what they want. The sort of idea is like, don't let them off the map. Like you have an area you want to play in, say Arkham or Innsmouth sort of thing. If they can wander anywhere within that sort of like ideal location you want, but if they start to go outside that map, then it's a completely different game that you're sort of trying to tell. And that's fine if you want to do that, but the session you planned for was not that. So you have to sort of redirect them like gently back into the story, or keep going in a different way and it's a completely different adventure, and that's fine too.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it kind of varies depending on the kind of game it is. So there's obviously sort of, you have one shot games where it's like you've got 3 to 4 hours and it's like, this is the mission, or this is the game, it's here, do this. And if people really start going off the map in that kind of game, then you can't, you've got to sort of pull them back into that because you've got a finite time, particularly if it's at a convention or something along those lines. Yeah. And then you have kind of your campaign mode where it's more of either a series of link scenarios in a particular area, or it's a longer campaign. And then people can go a bit more off-piste, if you like, because you've got more time to then, and actually sometimes the players can go into areas where it's actually becomes quite a good part of the story. You haven't planned it, but they are the players, they've got the agency. They go somewhere, things start happening, they might latch onto a particular NPC or a particular part of the area or something like that, and in their minds it's important, and they come up with a good plan which maybe you hadn't pre-planned. It's like, okay, this is good, we can run with this. But because you've got the time to be able to do that, you can in that kind of more campaign mode. So yeah, there are differences around the kind of what you're actually running as to how much freedom people have within that. But even within a one shot, the players should have agency in terms of following what they're going to be doing.
Yeah, the way I break it down is like the scenario is the plot of the what's going to happen, but the players make the story happen. It's like the story is the sort of things they go and tell their friends about in the pub afterwards. Sort of thing. This is what happened to me, and they sort of edit all the sort of bits that didn't sort of work for them, and they sort of get this sort of like polished sort of nice story at the end, and they craft that themselves through their own personal sort of encounter with the plot. The plot's happening in the background all the time. It'll just do its thing. It'll just move from one point to the next point. It depends what they do with it within that sort of time frame. For example, I've got one on a trade, and it's 4 hours to Reno. It's just it's like they're going from point A to point B. It depends what they do on that trade within that time, it's what happens to them. They can interact with things, or things will happen around them which they'll have to react to. So it depends what the player wants to be, reactive or sort of like proactive in solving the crime. And that was kind of like an Agatha Christie type scenario as well. It's like a murder on a train, you've got 4 hours to solve it before you get to like Reno, before the killer gets off and it's lost in the crowd sort of thing. So they've got to interview all the people who they were playing at the poker game that night on the train, and they've got to figure out this little locked room murder and all this sort of madness happening around them sort of thing.
Is that related to the anthology that Chaosium did, Madness on the Orient Express?
Horror on the Orient Express? No, it's not. That is a lengthy scenario, which takes you obviously on the Orient Express across the Alps and all that sort of thing. It's similar in a way that it's on a train, but when you get to actually read Horror on the Orient Express, none of it's really on the train. It's all on the stops along the route the train, which I was desperately disappointed in when I read it, because it's like, oh, that's cool. And that's one of the reasons why I did write it, actually.
Nice.
It was
nice.
I really wanted something that I can find moving sort of like train. They were stuck there. If they're going to jump off, they're going to break their legs sort of thing. You know, they're not going to go anywhere fast. So they've got to engage with this sort of craziness going on. All these people are hysterically sort of like wondering what's happening as well, and keep wanting to, you know, their attention basically in time.
We were very proactively engaged with the people on the train when we played it through.
You did. You harassed the hell out of them. Again, it's if you get a good group, like we play with our core group, Steph and all the other GMs on my server, it's like we usually have a very sort of off-the-wall players who will engage in ways which you'll never guess at. You should never try to guess at. You say, right, so this is happening, and that's just the direction you go in, and you try and make the best of it as they sort of try and break things, basically.
But that's what keeps it fresh, I guess, in a way, and keeps it away from being that. Or, you know, sometimes you think an investigation game, like a story or a film, can be very procedural.
You know,
you can watch some of those crime programs, and I always thought CSI, you know, they've got 50 minutes, you know they're going to solve it at the end. You know? Which is a bit sort of dull. So I guess it's getting that balance between that freedom to roam, but having those little set pieces where most horror films are in a confined space, like Alien or whatever it is, you know?
I usually go on signposts to events, and then the events will happen whether that person is there or not. And if they're not there, then the fallout of that event will sort of carry on to the next sort of thing. So they're always going to bump into their own disasters along the way. And yeah, it's all about signposting and making sure that carrot is good enough for them to be interested. It's like going back to Reno, it's like there's a section on the train where originally they're deputies to take these criminals to basically a federal court sort of hearing from a different place in the sort of like the east side of America. And they're sort of transporting these people, and they have to go and investigate and leave these criminals by themselves with just their sort of head US Marshal sort of looking after this old guy who's sort of injured from capturing them. He's got a bullet in his arm. It's gone gangrenous sort of thing. And like halfway through the sort of interviews, they break out, and there's a whole sort of breakout. And because they've broken out and they know that it's dangerous, every single player without fail run towards that car. And the whole point of it is misdirection, because it lets the killer kill again, sort of thing. So they're all eager. You see it in the player's face, they sort of light up, and they're sort of like the meta gaming. So, yeah, my character's just wandering this way, and they sort of like run to the other end of the car, and it's always without fail. You can lead the player by the nose. Everyone says you can never lead a player, but you can definitely lead a player. Yeah. So just make sure the carrot is what the players want, and they should buy into it.
I think one of the main problems or challenges when you're a ref with a Cthulhu game and the investigation, and obviously these cosmic horrors which are happening around them, particularly with Cthulhu, where it's like you could be an antiquarian or a chef or a policeman or something, and there's that whole aspect of, well, it is kind of reality, but it's like, why don't we all just walk off and go and tell someone in the government to sort out what's going on over there? There's always that kind of little bit of conceit that everyone has to sort of buy into it. But obviously you can build into the game or the particular session why people are there, etc. But there is always that element of people can walk off. It's partly why I kind of like the Delta Green version of the mythos in terms of gaming.
Right.
Because, it is like the government are covering it up. You're part of this secret organization that's actually involved with that to do that. And I think that really bolsters the ability of the ref to be able to say, well, you're here, this is your mission, this is what you've got to do. And it kind of really nicely swerves that whole issue generally.
Yeah.
Hooks are the hardest thing to write on a scenario,
yeah,
without a doubt. It's one of the things which you'll sort of like have to think about the most, because if you get some players who will just buy into anything no matter what, because they're just there to have a good time with their mates, and they're the best type of players when it comes to glossing over these sort of bad hooks that you'll get in scenarios. They'll try to just sort of say, this is the thing, you can play any sort of like investigating like occupation you want, but eventually it comes down to like, why won't I just phone the police? So you have to make the police complete idiots, which is not a stretch of the imagination. You just have to like make them brutal, dumb, and not uncaring to your problems in life. They just want an easy life, so every time you phone the police, it's just going to cause massive hassles to the players. They're going to be disbelief, they're going to be seen as the criminals that they are, because they are criminals at the end of the day. They're always doing bad things, and so you always have these sort of cops sort of harassing them if they do that sort of thing, and getting involved and asking awkward questions. So because I invented a Columbo type character sort of that would always tail them sort of like and ask questions back in the day when I was doing modern sort of thing, just always popping up at the wrong times with the wrong questions. I just have one more question as they're sort of trying to shift a body and things like that. It's like you never want them to involve the police, so they have to have that personal connection. But personal connection is the way to do it. It's like if you're not going to go down the DG line, which is basically this is your job, you're going to do it no matter what, just go and do it. That's easy and solved. The other way to do it is you need a personal connection. You need to get the buy-in sort of thing. So either the family's involved, they're involved, they've got a personal burden that they have to actually step beyond that line and get involved in the situation. And once that's in there, you're solid sort of thing. I think the best scenario I did that with was off Sauron Clay, where it's like you're searching for your father in the woods.
That's the one Rob played in.
Nice. All right.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, you've got that personal drive to go forward,
The old gothic tropes,
Yeah.
I was going to say, because the old cliche ones are always like you inherit a mansion from your great uncle Wilfred, or someone goes missing. I think
there's some ridiculous ones out there, but everyone's just, oh, okay, then this is what we're doing. But you will get the odd player that goes, no, make me.
Yeah.
So I think, all right, no, I'm going to sit and have a cup of tea while you go upstairs and just find that body. I'm just going to sit in the lobby and watch the guy get thrown out the window and land in the street. Will I sip on a cup of coffee?
There's got to be that element of people are coming together to play a game, you know. So it's
you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was listening to a playback of I think it was a D&D thing the other day, and there was lots of jokes about farting and this kind of stuff from one or two of the players, and you could sense that the DM was getting a bit sort of pissed off. You know? So is that so much of a problem in Cthulhu, or are people a little more, I hesitate to use the word mature, because me and Tim will laugh at fart jokes as much as anyone.
Deploy the Shoggoth. Just deploy the Shoggoth and kill him. Get him out of the game.
Hounds of Tyndalos. That always works out.
Yeah, Hounds of Tyndalos. Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, I did actually play a game where a guy did get a spell that summoned the Hounds of Tyndalos. And he was trying to impress the other players. He said, I could definitely summon this thing, and everyone would prove it. So he summoned it and just got dragged away and died. That was like the first 20 minutes of the game. And the only things they squabbled over was who got his sacrificial knife.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Sort of thing. But yeah, players, tone and mood is something, going back to that. I mean, I sort of touched on a little bit. It's like humor is fine. It's all good in the sort of context. But see, everyone's cracking Monty Python jokes every 20 seconds. That gets a bit tired very, very fast when you're trying to build some atmosphere. And you do get players who just love that sort of thing. And again, it comes down to just be upfront with your players and say, look, this is going to be like a dark game with some levity in it, but there's going to be some limits on that. And if the players don't want that, they don't join that, or if they join it anyway, then you just have to, at the end of the day, say, look, this is maybe not for you, and maybe move them up to pulp, where the fart jokes and all that sort of thing is more sort of on the table. But yeah, it has to do with how much you want to control the moods, and it's very, very difficult to keep humour out of these things, because everyone will always go into the quotes. Quotes are the worst, basically.
Yeah. I think most people I've played with over the last 3 years or so, with the Cthulhu games, certainly have all been pretty good. But most of the games I've played have been online through Graham's server, and so there's a good community there of people that are experienced players and non-experienced players, but there's games we run on the server where it's like introductory games, people get into it. I would say probably the thing that saves it a lot is that, because this is an 18 plus server,
right? Yeah.
I think I'm right in saying so. You know, I think that helps. Obviously they're horror games, there's horror in it, there's all sorts of things going on, so yeah, we want to sort of have, or Graham wants that threshold. But as I talked to Rob about previously, where we met over in Bedford doing the gaming on the Monday night. Face-to-face gaming, I think, is always, for me, it's like the platinum level of gaming, when you can really riff off people when they're around the table and you can hold their attention. So that really helps. And I haven't had any problems with mobile phones or anything like that yet, really. That seems to all been fine. I think there's bonuses to doing it either way. But certainly face-to-face, I find you can get a little bit more traction in the game by doing it face-to-face.
Yeah, it's more personal, and people are less likely to act up. Online is always like, yeah, I can step away from this any minute and sort of thing. It's very anonymous sort of thing as well.
And get distracted as well by something that's going on.
Yeah. You know,
Well, that's something I find, because obviously with lockdown, I was doing online classes in what I teach, fitness and martial arts and various other things. And when you've got people in a room, you have control of the environment. I mean, even on a Monday night, although we're sharing a room with other gamers, everyone's there to game. There's that sort of atmosphere.
Yeah.
When you've got the Zoom thing, then I've had people's the doorbell rings because the Amazon guy has turned up, and you know, there can be so many distractions, and it immediately takes them out of whatever you're doing. So is that a challenge of online gaming, and how do you approach it differently?
It can be a challenge, but at the end of the day, you're going around the table asking people one at a time, and they will get some downtime to do whatever they want for that, maybe 10-15 minutes while you're dealing with other players sort of thing before it comes back to them. And generally people will just use that time to listen in while doing whatever they want to do. And yes, it can be galling. Some people have actually played computer games in the background, in the sort of thing, when they get really bored and they're not, because they sign up to games and something. Sometimes they don't like it because it's a new system or something like that. And then you can just hear them sort of like just checking out sort of thing when you're playing and sort of thing. You pass the buck to someone. And yeah, what we're doing, and that's the worst. That is the game killer.
That's horrible.
I do a lot of author round tables and things like that for book launches and things like this. I had a guy on once and I was sitting there and he wasn't paying any attention. He's looking over the other side of the screen. But because the way he'd set the room up, you could see the flashing lights reflecting off the side of his head. He's like, are you playing Sonic the Hedgehog?
What's interesting about Graham's server where we run there, so most of the time when we play on there, we don't have any video. It's all just audio.
Yeah.
So, and I actually prefer that when I'm gaming because I just don't want something else to look at, particularly if I'm reffing. I can't be looking at what's going on the screen and doing this and doing that. Hmm. So that's relatively unusual for a lot of sort of gaming online where people do it either through Zoom, et cetera, and they'll have the video on as well. So it's whether that's a bonus or not, I don't know, but it's certainly I don't pay attention to video when I'm online gaming because I'm always concentrating on something on the screen or doing something else. So it's not a problem from my perspective.
Yeah, the way I see it is more forgiving, just turning all the videos off, because if you're on camera all the time for 4 hours, it's sometimes you're just going to be a mess after like an hour. So like you can have your hand on your face, you're going to be eating and all, and no one wants to see that. So I accidentally seen people sort of like half naked stuffing their face and stuff. Yep. Like that. It's just turn it off. Let's just
Lovecraft would not be impressed by that, I'm sure.
Not at all.
No, he wouldn't
by either of those things.
For sure.
Especially if it was seafood they were eating, he would not be impressed at all, would he?
Love the ocean.
Yeah.
I was saying, so we've spoken about online gaming a little bit and face to face. Have either of you ever tried live action Cthulhu? So I know there is a group in the UK, and it's something that's always intrigued me. So obviously, with lockdown, that sort of disappeared for a while.
I've done LARPing, but obviously the fantasy stuff. Actually, I kind of dropped out of it a few years ago, but a lot of my friends they're heavily into it now. You know, they've got all the gear. They just went to one last weekend, so they keep on asking me to go. But I'm like, oh, God. But that's more the fantasy side. I didn't even know there was a Cthulhu option. I don't quite know how that would work. I guess I should go and find out. But it seems a bit of an odd one.
Yeah, I'd be up for that. I've done LARPing myself. I used to do Napoleonic War stuff because I used to be in a pirate sea shanty band.
Pirate hell.
It's old dirty sea shanties, you know, and we ended up playing all these LARPing festivals. And obviously, you know, you've had a couple and you get involved.
Oh, man.
It was great fun. Nice. Whacking people with a rubber sword.
Yeah, sounds awesome. Yeah, I've never done LARPing before. I've seen it happen, especially in Edinburgh, Glasgow. The vampire scene back in the 90s was huge for LARPing. Used to go to things like the Cat House in Glasgow, and you'd see people like, it's a proper nightclub, and people were still LARPing in the nightclub sort of thing. And it's like, oh, what you did?
Yeah, that
seems very sad, but I'm sure they're enjoying themselves, but that seems very sad.
There was a local group down here in Brighton when I first moved here, and the pub I worked in, we had a function room upstairs, and it was next to the kitchen. I was the chef, and they used to go in there, and I'd be in there like doing stuff, and I'd hear them like shouting and swearing and going, and all this. And the thing is, we had CCTV cameras because obviously, and we were down behind the bar, and you could watch them, and they're sort of running about and all this. It looked like great fun, to be fair.
From what little I've seen of the Cthulhu stuff, it's very much almost like the murder mystery weekend kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then I think the monsters are quite low key, so you might have someone dressed as a ghoul or something like that.
I foresee there'd be lots of ghouls and ghasts in the Cthulhu universe.
Yeah, maybe some undead guy or something like that. I don't think you're going to... I mean, how'd you do a shoggoth? You know, you need...
Well, saying that, a mate of mine used to run Call of Cthulhu, and he actually had a rubber tentacle made up. And he used to get a mate to hide in the cupboard and poke it out and tickle every back of people's heads with it. It was just like brilliant.
You could dress up your dog as a tiddler's hound and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, you could do all that.
Cat, shog off. There you go. Just put
Easy. Well, I'm actually a prop maker and a sculptor, so I could help you a bit with that sort of thing if you ever want props and things for that sort of thing. You could do pretty thing. It's like you could pump a room full of smoke or something like that to like represent something happening that's weird in a room for Call of Cthulhu LARPing or something like that. And then you could bring in someone in a sort of shaky looking foam costume sort of thing. Yeah, I think that would work. Not too bad.
Yeah, this guy borrowed my smoke machine before to do that.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, it's been a goth DJ. I have two.
Of course. One's never enough.
And one's never enough.
Funny enough, I've got two as well.
Hey!
And I think, again, that's largely down to setting, isn't it? If you were playing in a nice big old manor house somewhere or something. Although, I mean, again, the horror is available anywhere, right? You can be in a modern flat or something and you can still run it, but I think those places come with a certain atmosphere already, which will probably help.
Yeah, the abandoned factories, that's what you need, something like that, run around some of those sort of thing.
We could do those zombie runs, can't you, where it's like abandoned old shopping centers and stuff, and you can pay to go in there and you can interact with the zombies and push them over, and it's kind of all professional. I mean, it looks amazing, but
I've done a zombie run before. They're really good.
Oh, nice.
We did one in Newcastle, maybe 10 years back, something like
that. Wow.
It was exhausting. It's like you're really not fit sort of thing until you get chased by zombies sort of like down the piers and all that sort of thing. But you had little rooms you go into, you've got to get the key code from the middle, sort of like the computer and that sort of thing. Yeah, and
oh, that's
sort of
good.
You see half of them have like dipped out and have stopped at a pub along the way, and all the rest of it. It's pretty good fun. Yeah, I like that a lot.
They've run one in an industrial estate down here.
Oh, right.
I always keep meaning to do it. Yeah, you meet up, they put you on a bus, they take you out to this it's an old rundown industrial estate. The thing is, only got like one working factory on it, and then they just chase the crap out of you all night.
There'll be loads of old abandoned factories at Innsmouth, so that's maybe where we can go at some point.
Oh, there we go.
It's getting
the people back out again. That's the problem. We have to do a head count every trip. We've only lost a couple so far, but we don't talk about that very much. Right? Everyone signed a waiver and the insurance forms.
Sacrifices have to be made, I suppose.
But that would be a dream. I mean, to have a sort of Lovecraftian theme park or something like that.
Yeah.
The haunted mansion type experience, that would be a great thing.
There is a Lovecraft theme pub somewhere in the States. I don't actually think it's in Providence. I think it may be in New York.
I think it's shut down, that one.
That's a shame. That was on my bucket list.
I've got a feeling it's shut down.
It's one of those strange things, because the Call of Cthulhu game's been going for 40 years or whatever it is. Quite popular in terms of gaming. People kind of know of it if they haven't played it before, and they realize what it is. And it's always one of the things where, the films hit and miss, really, and the series hit and miss, that kind of thing. And you kind of think it's surprising it's never really got the push it needed in terms of cosmic horror and Lovecraft and those kind of things. I know there's difficulties maybe in writing and that, but with all the things they can do nowadays, with all these sorts of films that are out there, you just want someone decent to come and make a decent one, or do a theme park, or do something like that. It'll really get it going a bit.
Yeah. I mean, we were speaking last time about the Cabinet of Curiosities a little bit, which we didn't really want to speak about because the two adaptations,
not the best.
Yeah.
Not the best.
And you think, again, with the budgets nowadays and the CGI, it should be a no-brainer, really. But I think perhaps what it is that element of cosmic horror, that entertainment has to have a happy ending in mainstream Hollywood or whatever you want to call it, on Netflix,
I don't know. I think Colour Out of Space was good, the movie. I think they did that pretty well, considering the sort of material they had to work with. It's like, how do you describe or show something which doesn't exist?
Colours that don't exist.
So I think they did reasonable there. But I think the adaptations of Curiosity was fine. They were just a little bit too far from the source material places, sort of thing. And they sort of strayed a little bit. But adaptations, what are you going to do?
This is it, isn't it? It's the funny thing is, I was really excited about the adaptation of Pikmin's Bob,
because
I thought that's one that could be really relatively easy to do.
Yeah.
And then they just completely changed it. I actually preferred the old Night Gallery version from the 70s.
Yeah.
I thought that was a much better adaptation in my mind.
Some of the other stories, the ones which weren't related, were actually more Lovecraft as well.
Yes.
And they're sort of telling the way they did it. So I think the 80s one, where they're sitting around the sofas, I can't remember what it was called. Where they had the big statue at the end of it.
The Murmuring was the birds one.
That was terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Yeah. Lock 37 was obviously...
The first one.
The first one. It was the last one, wasn't it? And I can't remember the name of it.
I think it was the second last one. Yeah, it was weird. It was like they were sitting around with this guru and they sort of brought together for this statue. And then it burst out and, you know, sort of... Spoilers.
So if people are listening and have not tried Call of Cthulhu, perhaps they're into RPGs or perhaps not, or they want to get into it, what would you advise would be a good starting scenario for them?
The classic one that everyone goes to is The Haunting. That's the kind of classic first one, which people run. It has a lot of the elements. There's the investigative elements. There's a haunted house. There's some jump scares in it. There's a lot of weirdness in it, or the ref can put a lot of weirdness into it. And that one can then be used as a foundation stone to then lead into a number of other scenarios. You can put items in there or set up situations which then lead on to others. So that's normally the go-to one that most people start with. It's relatively simple if you're a new keeper, I think.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, The Haunting is designed for people who've played other roleplay games before but haven't played Call of Cthulhu. It's got the sort of bare bones of a good scenario. It's actually one of the best scenarios, I think, the way it's laid out. It's been adapted several times in 40 years or so. So it's kind of been polished to death. And it shows you've got a lot there. And it's very concise. And the story and investigation are very the good payoffs. And they've got a good amount of meat onto it. There's also the Lightless Beacon, which is on a sort of like... a small island with a lighthouse, and you've got a small murder investigation to do after being washed ashore from a sinking sort of ship. And there's Paper Chase as well, which is a lot more subdued. It's very classic Call of Cthulhu, where you have to solve the investigation, which is very simple investigation about missing books, and you sort of come across who's stealing the books and all that sort of thing. And you've got to sort out what you want to do with the situation when you discover what is happening. And you have a sort of elements of the sort of horror coming through there. I would say I'd stick with The Haunting, though. It's probably the best one. It's a classic.
And what would be your, if you had to pick one all-time favourite scenario, whether it's a part of a campaign or a one-shot thing, what would you say? What's the best one you've played or run, you think?
Crimson Letters, without a doubt. It's in the Keeper's handbook, and it is a sandbox scenario. I'd say you need some... experience to run it out of the gate. So if you pick up Call of Cthulhu, run two or three before you attempt it, because it's very open-ended and it gives you a lot of elements and a lot of story that you can play with, but it leaves a lot to the keeper's will and imagination and what the players are going to actually do as well. It's a simple investigation of a locked room mystery, sort of death, and it takes you down some dark tunnels, but there's a massive cast of very good characters for the GM to get their teeth into, which makes the difference in a lot of scenarios you come across don't have that sort of like depth of character involved in it. And it's just it's a very visceral and dark scenario at the end of it as well. There's lots of ways it can end, so it's you're left to pick the sort of villain yourself as well as the keeper. So out of that sort of like Agatha Christie sort of selection of characters, you get to choose who actually did it, which is unique in itself as well.
That's a nice thing.
It's always been a favourite of mine.
Nice
sort of thing.
And if you run it for other people, then you can change the antagonist basically, you know, within it. It's kind of built to be like that
for sure.
Yeah, how about you, Steph?
Crimson Letters is a go-to one. I think probably so. Of Sorrow and Clay that Graham wrote, actually I think that's a really neat scenario. No, just because of the payoff at the end, you know, it's got a really nice sort of reveal, which I think is really good. And for a smallish scenario, it's really evocative of the times, kind of place it's set, etc. So I'd say that's a really good one to run, and I like running that. But probably the one I've run, which I like the best, has been Blackwater Creek, which again written by Scott Dorwood and co. I think it came with the Keeper's Screen as part of the additional material for that, I think, and that's set in Arkham, around that area, I think, and you've got the investigators have to go and figure out what's going on in this particular area, and there's two routes in. You can either go as a load of gangsters, or you can go as from the Miskatonic University. So there's kind of two ways you can play it effectively, nice. Which means you can sort of vary up a little bit between different groups, but I really enjoy that, the sort of the area is really well described. There's encounters within that which you can link up. There's various things to investigate, and lots of cosmic horror, which is always great.
that's a good descriptions in that one, like the sort of like oily tongues and stuff like that.
The plant tongues. Life going crazy and all that kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. It's nice. Really good.
Got some good stuff in it, that one.
Nice. Yeah.
How about you, Tim? Have you got a favourite?
Oh, it's been so long since I've actually done any. So I can't actually remember any of them off the top of my head.
We were talking about Mask and the Alathotep a little bit earlier, weren't we?
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably it, but it's so involved. Well, I like that more kind of involved scenario, the ones that go on and on and on and on. I like that kind of investment. I think that's probably, for me, is the pinnacle of what I played. So, yeah.
The one I'd choose, apart from Masks, it was a sort of one shot. It's called Grace Under Pressure, which was set in a scientific mini sub research thing in the depths of the Pacific.
Nice. I've never actually heard of it.
Yeah. It must have been, this would have been sort of mid, late 80s, probably late 80s, actually. And one thing that made it so memorable was we turned the house into a mini sub. So we had the sonar sound playing on loop.
Oh, excellent.
Had little green lights everywhere, and the kitchen was the galley, and the, you know, and it was such a tight little compact thing, and of course Deep Ones turn up and etc. But yeah, a really nice little atmospheric one. Really did enjoy that. Right.
Need to hunt it out. Yeah,
we played through Masks. Did we finish that last year? I've lost track of the year.
Yeah, we finished it sort of mid last year, I think. Yeah, last summer, I think, and it was a huge campaign. Like we played in blocks. Basically, I break it into a chapter. You do a chapter, then you take a month off just to reset, and you do the next chapter sort of like once you're sort of ready to get back into it. And yeah, we played, I think, maybe 50 sessions or something like that. Four sessions, sort of thing. And yeah, we managed to finish that before I managed to finish a 4-hour one shot with Scott Dorwood. Which ran for about a year as well. For some reason, we just kept on. Again, we didn't engage with the story. We just kept going in circles. So beware of that sort of thing. but yeah, it's Max is good. It's very. Yeah. It suffers a lot from being the granddaddy of all scenarios. Mm. It is the pinnacle of what was out there, and every single person has picked away at it and chewed at it and taken little bits and like made them into their own scenarios. So a lot of the elements have been done to death and troped and all the rest of it, but it all comes back to it started there with Masks sort of thing. So you won't be surprised probably as you would be with some of the story aspects, because it's very, very traditional storytelling and using a lot of the traditional sort of archetypes within it. But yeah, it's well worth the playthrough. And again, it's not really about the plot. It's about the stories the players tell for themselves within that plot. And we had some pretty good ones. We went back in time as well.
All sorts of strange stuff was going on.
Yeah.
Time travel, there's a conundrum.
Oh, yeah, that was a problem. We went back to save a player and killed themselves in the past and all that stuff.
Perfect.
It wasn't the most well thought out plan at the time, but there you go.
Yeah.
I can see that setting up all sorts of problems for a keeper.
Yeah, it was off the cuff as well. We're going to paint this painting and we're going to step into the painting and we're going to like paint a scene of like us coming through this house and save one of the players. And yeah, I didn't didn't know that was going to happen. And this, sometimes you got to just roll with it, as a keeper, and say, all right, see what you've got, and let them do it. So got to be quick on your feet sometimes. But as long as everyone's having fun, that's the main point, I guess.
Yeah,
definitely.
So shall we talk about conventions?
Indeed.
If I fill in a little bit of backstory here, as you know, Tim and I and Shelley, Graveheart Designs, are organising the Innsmouth Literary Festival, September the 30th in Bedford. And this is how I got to know Steph, because although I've lived in, well, near Bedford for about the last 15 years, and I've been keep meaning to get back into gaming and wargaming and everything else, I never really got around to it. And then Steph dropped me a line and said, I see you're doing this festival in Bedford. I'm in Bedford. I play Call of Cthulhu. Come along for a session. And so I did.
Nice.
And you kindly agreed to help out on the day with our gaming room.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. Yeah, it'd be great.
Which we're looking forward to. So when it comes to convention gaming, how do you approach it? Obviously, we're looking at one-shots. How do you work those?
So normally we'd be looking at anything from two to 4 hours kind of game length that can be finished in that time, so it's contained. And if anyone wants to run a game, a Call of Cthulhu game or Pulp or Act on Cthulhu or any of the other Cthulhus, I guess, then I guess if they contact you via the Innsmouth Literary Festival web pages, there's a contact on there, then they can let us know. We're basically putting a net out to try and find as many people as we can to run some games and offer them up to people that are going to be attending. Or if you've got a group of friends that want to come along, then that's great as well. So I'll be running a game there. I think Graham's volunteered to run one as well.
I'll run a game or two, yeah.
Nice.
There you go. So we'll be running games there. And I think there'll be the Bedford Gladiators Role Playing Club, which we are now members of as of Monday, just gone.
Yes, we are, as of Monday, yeah.
we paid in blood. Then
we signed that funny Latin archer thing. Yeah.
Everything's fine. Then they will also be there. They're more obviously wargaming, but they're looking at doing some twists on their wargaming to make it more Lovecraftian, I guess. Maybe cultists versus deep ones or something. I don't know. They're going to have a think about that as well. So that should be good fun. And I think they might have some participatory games as well, so people can turn up and join in with the wargaming as well. So get a handle on that. So yeah, hopefully we'll have quite a few games running. But as I said, anyone wants to run a game at the Innsmouth Literary Festival on September 30th, contact the website and let us know, and they'll put you in touch with me, I guess, and then we'll work it out from there.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll start getting everything coordinated over the next couple of months. I think it's one of those things you said, I think September's a long way off, but it's going to suddenly be right there, isn't it? But yeah, it's good. We've got about half the trader spaces full now and everything else, and tickets have gone on sale. So
nice.
Yeah, so I think that's all going well.
Yeah, like I say, it is seems like a way off, but have you got any ideas percolating yet? Any ideas of what scenario you're going to be doing? Anything like that? Anything in the works?
No, not at the moment. I'm actually setting up a couple of campaigns and still doing some other stuff in terms of one-shots. So I'm going to play through some more of the one-shot scenarios which are available over the course of the summer, and then I'll probably pick one nearer the time. Nice. I've got a couple of ones that I go back to normally anyway, but I want to get some more in that repertoire. So, but it will be something suitably horrific, put it that way.
Excellent. Excellent.
I'll probably try and run some of my new scenarios just to test them out on sort of random people, see what I can sort of reaction I get.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's always pigs, a good thing to do. Just make sure you get that cold reaction. And yeah, so I'll probably bring along a couple of those. I do a lot of Old West scenarios. That's sort of my bag. So if you're interested in being on the Old West with Weird West stuff in Cthulhu, I'll probably be the guy to go to for that sort of thing.
And just to set the expectation for people out there that are coming to play, maybe the first time they've played, don't expect to survive. Just putting it out there.
Yeah. Yes. Just don't. Yeah.
Well, we've found that on a Monday night, and we'll run through a couple, and I think the survival rate has been zero so far. Actually, I was explaining to my wife about, no, one guy did survive, but he became a kind of incubation pod the eggs of some strange creature, which is probably rather a rad diet, to be honest.
Someone did survive, but their brain was in a jar flying off with Amigo.
It's all good, horrific fun. It's all good.
Excellent. Right, well, I see the sun is sinking over the horizon and I hear the bus is turning up outside, so it's getting to time for us to leave. Of course, you two guys get to stay here overnight because that's all part of the Innsmouth experience we like to offer.
Excellent. All good. Yeah.
We recommend pushing the dressing table up against the door, or, you know.
Take the lock off the trouser press, you know.
But of course, before we go, we've just got a couple of little announcements. Oh, we had a message in on YouTube.
Indeed. Yeah, we got a message from Rick Kennett, and he's talking about the last episode we did, which was when we were looking at E. Nesbitt's man-sized marble. And he says, I love this story, but there's one thing that bothers me. Although she desperately needs not to be at the cottage when the giant killer statues return to their old home on that one night of the year, kindly and motherly Miss Dorman has no qualms in leaving her employers in ignorance of the danger they face in remaining there. It's a very, very good point.
It is a very good point. The story, briefly, for anyone who hasn't read it, is a couple move into this sort of tumble-down cottage that it turns out the previous owners return in statue form once a year and murder anyone in the cottage. And the housekeeper neglects to mention this to the young couple and just says, it's Halloween, isn't it? Oh, I have to go visit my niece on Halloween.
Bye. She's ill. Yeah, that's it. Her niece is ill. Yeah. She does sort of give them vague clues, but not. Yeah. She just said, get out. There's a statue. It's going to come and rip your head off.
She just kind of revealed the story under duress. But I thought, in a way, that's quite a Call of Cthulhu scenario thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you could definitely see that as a conceit.
Yeah. It's when we got the comment through, I started thinking, and it's like the amount of times you see that these people who know what's going to happen, and they'll sort of drop cryptic clues, but they'll never actually say, you know, they're always like, well, I'm getting out of here. You should as well. It's just like,
yeah, I'm going.
Yeah,
I'm
bye.
On the other hand, that is quite a trope in a lot of these stories, is that it's the locals and don't be going up to the castle. And
no digging here.
No digging here, yeah.
Well, it's like an American horror. It's always the old geezer by the gas station, isn't it? You know, the straggly old guy by the gas station who stinks of moonshine, you know.
It's your trope, yeah.
We know someone like that, don't we, Tim? Just
around the corner.
Hanging out.
Zadok. Yeah, exactly. I think he's the first, isn't he?
Funny enough, I started watching the Hills Have Eyes film for the first time on the train home yesterday. I hadn't seen it in decades, right? And the first scene, it was the old guy in his little garage that's obviously the grandfather of the mad family. Yeah. And then the normal family turn up. And instead of telling them, get out of here immediately, you've got to leave, run away, he just kind of says, just don't go down there. Just don't do that. He can't. He's a little bit kind of like, don't do it. But in the end, they just ignore him and carry on anyway. But yeah, very similar.
Mm.
I suppose it's a little bit like, don't press the red button. So thanks for that, Rick. That was a very good point, and we missed that totally. So thanks for bringing that up. The other person I want to thank is Tobias Nielsen for getting in touch, sent us a lovely email. We'll maybe have a chat with Tobias at some time. He's based in Denmark. He's got a very interesting blog, which we'll put a link to. He's writing stories, he's an extra in films, he's involved in a lot of different projects. So thanks for getting in touch, Tobias. And of course, a big thanks to all our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, then do please check out our Patreon site. You get a regular copy of Innsmouth News. You get access to all our bonus content, both for the Innsmouth Book Club and for Strange Shadows, our Clark Ashton Smith podcast. We're going to be doing more merch this year, so you get a discount on the merch that we're going to be bringing out. And of course, you get free entry to the Innsmouth Literary Festival and any other events that we might organise as well. And you'll be supporting the show. It allows us to spread our tentacles even further.
Yeah, so that's pretty much about it for this week, isn't it? But join us next time. The winner of our poll that we put up recently for the choice of next story was Horror from the Hills by Frank Belknap Long. So we'll be looking at that next time.
That's a real good... I've forgotten how long that story was, actually. The elephant god, Chalgna Fawn.
Yeah, it's sort of novelette, isn't it? Sort of, yeah. On the cusp of being novella.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Okay, hope you can join us for that. Thanks again for listening, and super thanks again to our guests, Graham and Steph. Thanks for coming in, guys.
It's great, thanks.
No, awesome. Sounds good.
And with that, it's goodbye from me, Rob Poynton.
And it's goodbye from me, Tim Mendes.